Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Herd immunity. It is the latest pandemic goal, but what does it actually mean? And is it even possible? Well, in a state as diverse as California, you can imagine it is complicated. Cal Matters is going to join us to help us sift through the challenges facing 58 counties that are ultimately intertwined. And they'll explain how two unlikely counties actually have something in common. Herd immunity is within reach. Also, fuel shortages across the country last week brought back one of the more unsavory qualities of coping with uncertainty: panic buying. We're going to spend some time understanding the psychology behind bare store shelves and empty gas stations. Later in the hour, Asian American history spans two centuries in the United States, and now classrooms of all grade levels are learning about the struggles and the triumphs in ways really not seen before. But first, life may be feeling a little bit more like normal, finally. However, for frontline workers, the relentless stress and trauma of helping others during the past year is still very much present. I mean, if you recall, at its peak, the pandemic left hospitals and first responders short-staffed, not to mention at high risk, with few supplies to get them through the day. First responders, they know very well how to rescue and care for others during dangerous situations. Today, we're going to turn the conversation in the opposite direction. We're going to look at the mental health toll they in turn shoulder and the resources that are available. Joining us now to discuss mental health and first responders is Sacramento Fire Department Captain Richard Alamo. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, good morning, Vicky. Thank you for having us on the show.
Well, you know, Captain Alamo, when you look back on the past year, I mean, just kind of everything happened kind of so quickly, and it also felt it was so extreme. The additional protective equipment you had to wear, responding to a new virus with unknown challenges, then going home to families and loved ones. I mean, y'all are so used to running into dangerous situations to help others. But how do you reflect on a year with the different types of risks that you were facing?
It was extremely challenging and fluid because things were constantly changing, right? We got into an area where we thought things were starting to get better, and then they took a turn for the worst. It was extremely challenging because we had, there was a lot of unknowns regarding COVID and how it was being spread. Additionally, you know, we were responding to calls where we were constantly being exposed to COVID and taking it home to our families. So it was a very challenging year, not only for us for the in the fire service, but for everybody across the country as well.
You see the worst with the goal of making it safer, making it better. You know, it's hard to check that when you clock out. And I would imagine this past year with the pandemic and COVID-19 added an extra weight to that.
Yes, it did. First of all, we had to take extra precautions as well as we were going into homes with folks who were exhibiting symptoms but not confirmed COVID-19. So we were having to take extra safety precautions when we were going into homes as well as around the fire station and when we went home to our families as well.
What moments in the past year stick with you?
Wow. The moments that stick with me the most is how we were able to come together as an agency to not only make sure that we met the goals or to take care of the public, but also to take care of one another and our families at home as well. The department took a very proactive stance on protecting our members as well and educating us and giving us as much tools as possible and equipment to make sure that we not only expose ourselves, but the public as well. So I think that the teamwork that I saw across, not only with our organization, but across the country, is something that sticks out to me the most.
You, given the unprecedented challenges and risks that you all faced as first responders, what did you learn from that as a department that you're now applying within the department in terms of resources and support?
Absolutely. There's been a lot of lessons that have been taken away from this past year. As far as we were able to build resources, obviously this pandemic was very challenging just because of the unknowns from the pandemic, but we were able to utilize teams to test our members to make sure that we knew right away if we were carriers. And also we were able to get together a peer support team, if you will, to reach out to our members who were exposed and were going home and having difficulties with that as well. So I think one of the things that we learned is that as an agency, we are able to adapt and overcome challenges so that we can carry out the goals not only of the department, but to watch out for our members and the families as well.
I was reading articles last year, Kaiser Permanente in particular. They were highlighting the mental health risks of first responders. And this was an article of November of last year, really in the middle of this pandemic. And they found that 85% of first responders have experienced symptoms related to mental health conditions. But really was kind of most sobering and striking for me was that they found that police officers and firefighters are more likely to die by suicide than in the line of duty. I think that may surprise a lot of people, not just myself, given that this is your passion and you work within this department and as a first responder, does this surprise you?
Yes, I was surprised at first when I started looking at the numbers of firefighter suicides. It was surprising to me because, first of all, there's such a stigma behind mental health and suicide as well. And as I looked at the numbers back in, and we'll just take it back to 2019. In 2019 alone, we had 121 firefighters who died of suicide, as compared to line of duty deaths, which is, you know, firefighters who die going into burning buildings or cancer or other line of duty deaths. We had 58. So the number is twice as much. The thing with firefighter suicide is that it's self-reported. So they're estimating that the numbers are a lot greater than what's out there because of the stigma behind it. Families don't feel comfortable reporting that their firefighters have died of suicide.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Sacramento Fire Department Captain Richard Alamo about mental health and first responders. You know, looking at another study, it was conducted by the University of Phoenix, and I don't think you're going to find this surprising. It said found that 7 in 10 first responders say mental health services are seldom or never utilized. And you touched upon this issue of the cultural stigma surrounding asking for help. There was a fear of demotion or repercussions or being looked at differently. What needs to change, or what is currently changing within fire departments and within departments of first responders to help change that stigma, to make it okay and comfortable to seek help when you need it?
Absolutely, and that's a great question. I'm glad you asked that. First of all, here as an agency, we are taking the lead throughout our region to shed a light on mental health and to educate our members and make them feel comfortable with raising their hand and having the courage to say that they need help. There is a huge stigma behind asking for help and mental health services, but we're actually getting better. Our agency has hired a full-time behavioral health coordinator, which is myself, to help our members bridge the resources that we have available to our members, and also to educate our members on the services that are available to them in case they do need help. It's this week, as a matter of fact, this week is Mental Health and Suicide Awareness Week. And we're encouraging all our members to have those uncomfortable conversations about mental health and suicide. And not only that, to also share the resources that are available to them. Currently, we're with our union, we're building a robust behavioral health program to better serve our firefighters and their families as well.
How do you have a conversation with an individual that may be coping with substance abuse due to the mental health that they're enduring?
Absolutely. A lot of it is active listening. We as firefighters, we're used to helping people, right? We're fixers. We solve problems. You dial 911, you call us, we show up. We solve your problem. A lot of times when we are talking to one of our peers, when they're coming to us with a problem, we already have 10 different solutions for them as well. So it's becoming important to be an active listener. And we have trained 54 peer members in our agency. They've gone through a 24-hour training. And when they're trained in active listening, resource management, and crisis management as well. And so with those tools and that training that we've had, we've been able to listen, share. Not only there's a lot of us that I myself have struggled with substance abuse, so I have experience in the 12 steps programs as well, but saying, hey, you know what, I understand, I know where you're coming from, this is what's available to help you out, and let's get you some help. And nine times out of ten, a lot of our members are having the courage to raise their hand and say, yes, I need help me.
And I would imagine those peer leaders would just be so instrumental, because it allows someone to feel as though they're not alone, and someone who's an equal and a colleague has experienced something similar and can help them get through it.
Absolutely. We found it helpful to have peers that you can relate to and understand what you're going through. It's easier to talk to a peer about some things at work that might be bothering you, and they would be able to help you find the resources that you need to get the help that you need.
How do you help someone who wants to leave the profession because of all the stress and the trauma that they're enduring?
Absolutely. That's a good question. We are actually the state of California in last year in 2020 passed California Emergency Services Act. And in that act, it outlines peer support programs, as well as there is a law that now considers post-traumatic stress injury is what we're calling it. And it is presumptive, meaning that if a member is experiencing post-traumatic stress from the line of work that they do, it's presumptive that that's how they sustained that injury. So when a member is struggling and wants to leave and gets to that point, we have resources available to help them to see where they're at. We have vetted clinicians that we ourselves have vetted out through a process of interviewing them. And they've also done ride-alongs with us. And so they understand what our job entails. So we've been able to line our members up with better clinicians that use modalities to help them navigate and process some of those traumatic events, as well as psychologists and psychiatrists that we utilize to help our members out.
Finally, as things are looking better on a pandemic front, it just really feels like y'all don't get a break, because we're heading into a potentially dangerous and devastating wildfire season. And I know that you'll head out to that as well and help communities. What are your concerns now heading into the summer and heading into the months, despite, you know, perhaps, you know, we're kind of rounding that long overdue turn with COVID-19?
Concerns, there hasn't been a break for our members. With COVID, it's been very difficult and taxing on our agents and our members as well. You know, our members were also contracting COVID, and we were closing down firehouses because COVID was spreading through there. Our department is constantly staffed 24/7. So the public, when they dial 911, they expect that we're going to show up. And so what that's happening, it's someone needs to pick up the slack. And so our members are overworking right now. They're working extra hours to cover the department. We're now, with COVID starting to improve, now we're looking into fire season. So my concern is that there hasn't been a break for our members. They're overworking extra hours. And so with fire season coming up, I don't feel that we're going to get the much needed break that we need.
Sacramento Fire Department Captain Richard Alamo, thank you for joining us, and thanks for all that you do.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on the show.
Up next, are we close to reaching herd immunity? Some, particularly two counties, are closer than others. We're going to get an update on the vaccination rate in the state. Plus, we'll also get a psychology lesson on why people panic buy. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Nearly half of eligible Californians are fully vaccinated, but the path towards that elusive herd immunity comes with twists and turns, and even defining what herd immunity actually is can vary. With a state as large and diverse as California, vaccination rates are like a dramatic pendulum swing. But each of the state's 58 counties are ultimately intertwined. It's not like we're self-contained islands. And the reasons why some are more successful than others may surprise you. CalMatters health reporter Ana Ibarra sifted through all of these challenges and joins us with her latest reporting. Ana, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks for having me, Vicky.
Yeah, and I think starting off, the fact that there are two counties that are on the surface seems so different, yet they have something in common in terms of how successful they've been in vaccination rates. Can you break down those two counties, the Bay Area County and the rural county? That's actually not too far from us in Sacramento.
Yeah, so those two top counties are Marin County and Alpine, right? So you have one rural county. Alpine is also the smallest county population-wise in California. And then you have Marin, which is one of the more affluent counties. And so for this analysis, I did take a look at fully vaccinated people, because of course that's what you need for true protection. And so we saw that 13 counties have fully vaccinated at least half of its 16 and over population, and eight of those top counties were in the Bay Area. So you have Marin County, Alpine, Mono, San Francisco, Contra Costa, San Mateo, Alameda, and Santa Clara counties.
When you look at keep going. Ana, sorry.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so I was going to say, then at the bottom of the list, you have counties like Lassen, Mariposa, Kings, Tehama, Yuba, Merced, and Trinity. And those counties had less than 30% of residents 60 and over fully vaccinated.
When you look at all of those counties, the ones that are at the bottom and the ones that are successful, it's kind of a mixed bag. And some of these counties are actually near each other, yet one is towards the bottom and the other is towards the top. What attributes to this?
Yeah, so there are several factors that seem to be at play. So, in counties with rural or remote areas, you have issues like transportation at play. In agricultural areas, there are some sense that things like taking time off work is a barrier. Health experts I talked to raised the point that because so much of the pandemic has been politicized, you will often see counties, even if they're neighbors, but one tends to vote more red and one tends to vote more blue, they'll have very different vaccination uptake. And so, of course, there's exceptions to that, but that was one of the points that I thought was very interesting. And even some, counties, for example, in the Central Valley, you do have, one large city at least, and then you have more remote areas. So those communities will differ.
In your reporting, you brought up not only herd immunity, but also community immunity. And the definition can actually vary depending on what health official you're talking to and whether it's looking at just eligible people or the total population.
Correct. So, children under 12 cannot be vaccinated yet. The vaccine hasn't been approved for them, but they're obviously still part of the population. So it's important to consider total population when we think about protection. But because, we're not there yet, a lot of counties are focusing their efforts on this eligible population. And the numbers I looked at were of last week. So obviously, that was 16 and people 16 and over. So while it is useful, to see how each county is doing when we talk about immunity, like you said earlier, you also can't just look at the county, at one county, because there's so much movement, between counties. So you have people commuting, for example, in Sacramento, people live in Sacramento and work in the Bay Area. So, you really need to consider the entire state, but also the entire population.
I mean, LA County, which is, you know, obviously such a large county in California, they're pretty successful in terms of achieving immunity. I think you reported that they predict 80% immunity by July. But you also talk about the challenges that within successful counties, there are low vaccination pockets.
Yeah, correct. So, you know, Los Angeles County is a great example. It's a very populated county, and you will have some pockets, like you said, or zip codes that have very high vaccination uptake, but then you'll have some that are really falling behind. And, you know, I think a lot of those communities that are falling behind, unfortunately, are also some of those communities that were really affected by COVID-19, right? So it takes, I think, a lot of different messaging, even within a county, to get into two different populations and to reach those numbers of different communities.
You looked at how the data raises a lot of questions when looking at Alpine County, which, along with Marin County, they have the most successful vaccination rates per capita. But just up north, Lassen County, which is also a rural county, they have significantly less. They're towards the bottom of vaccination rates. Why is Alpine County doing better than counties like Lassen County, which are also rural?
Yeah. So one of the things I learned was that in the case of Alpine County, you know, first of all, they have a population about 1,100. And, you know, I talked to their public health officer there, and he told me he thinks that one of the reasons why Alpine is so successful is they really kept things simple, right? Because they have a small population, they opted for doing sort of a call-in appointment system. And so really when people called in, they were going to talk to him, the public health officer. So they knew who they were talking to. And of course, when you have a small population like that, you know, he can handle that. Then in the case of Lassen, you know, they're at the very bottom with about 21% of fully vaccinated residents. And speaking with their health officers, you know, their estimates were actually very different than what the state has in its data. And so I learned that Lassen, for example, doesn't count its prison population because they don't interact with the general population. And Lassen is unique because it has three prisons, two state and one federal. So, you know, Lassen officials have also been estimating that some people are getting their vaccines in neighboring Nevada state. And so that's why their numbers maybe look a little different than what the state has. The state, for example, does take into account prison populations.
That's such a great point, because it's not only that all counties are intertwined, but we also have neighboring states as well, especially when you're going to northern counties, which border Oregon, and all eastern counties, which border Nevada. And is there any way to find out if people are actually crossing state lines to get vaccinated and then coming back home?
Yeah, I think in my reporting, that was probably one of the most interesting things I found, you know, that those counties in the California-Nevada border, speaking to public health officers, they do believe, or at least when they do outreach in their community, they learn from those community members that they have, you know, when they do their shopping in Reno, for example, they go and get their vaccines there. States don't share vaccination information with each other. And so I checked with Nevada Public Health, you know, and they mentioned that people don't need to provide a full address to get a vaccine there. So you may indeed have some people who really are getting vaccinated in Nevada, and California really has no way to know or to count how many of those shots were given for California residents in Nevada. So, you know, I think we really have very little way to know what that number looks like.
You also found that past or historically prior public health crises have helped some counties if they responded to them appropriately, particularly the Bay Area, which has been pretty successful with vaccination rates.
Yeah, so that was another interesting tidbit. One expert I spoke to from UC Berkeley, you know, he mentioned that in the 1980s, the Bay Area was the epicenter of the AIDS crisis, and the community really learned to trust public health officials and their elected officials there. And, you know, he thinks that is having sort of an, he called it a halo effect, you know, to what we're seeing now, just the, a good healthy sense of trust between the community and public health.
Finally, with all of your reporting, I mean, you really sifted through all of these nuances and layers of vaccination rates. When talking with public health experts, infectious disease experts, is herd immunity or community immunity, I don't know if that's interchangeable, is that actually achievable for us?
Yeah, I think a lot of the public health experts I spoke to seem to be pretty optimistic. When exactly that would happen was, you know, obviously that's the unknown. I think really what I'm hearing is that once the vaccine is available for children, for younger children, it will just be a lot easier. You know, I think the state, for example, hasn't really come out with a percentage or a number that we have to achieve. And I think that's because, you know, you don't want to give a false sense that once we reach this magic number, we're in the clear. You know, we still have to protect those children and get kids vaccinated. So, I think there's... really the message is, I think the more people that get vaccinated, the better we'll all be.
CalMatters health reporter Anna Ibarra, thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
Yes, thank you, Vicky.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, before herd immunity became a conversation centerpiece, panic buying found its frustrating place in the pandemic. I mean, toilet paper, need we say more? You know, I never thought I'd be so tuned into inventory restocking days at grocery stores. And after really a few bouts of surges of empty store shelves throughout the year, things seemed to be looking up. But if we thought all of that was in the past, last week proved we're far from wrong. Gas stations in southeastern states experienced a gas shortage after news Colonial Pipeline stopped service after the company's systems were hacked. Now, this caused many to buy as much gasoline as possible. Now, in the case of the panic buying of gasoline, there wasn't yet a shortage of gas until people started to hoard it. So joining us now to help us understand why people go out and panic buy items in large quantities is professor and clinical psychologist at the University of British Columbia, Dr. Stephen Taylor. Welcome to Insight.
Thanks very much, Vicky.
Yeah, Dr. Taylor, you came out with a book last year, The Psychology of Pandemics, and you wrote it before COVID. I mean, the timing couldn't be more perfect.
Well, I started that book in 2018. Those of us who work in the area knew a pandemic was coming, but I didn't realize it was coming so soon after the publication of the book.
And I would imagine it kind of it reaffirmed what you had already written, because there is a psychological phenomenon when it comes to pandemics.
Well, you know, it was funny. When I was writing the book in 2018, I'd go around to friends and colleagues and I'd be talking about what I was doing, and I'd be saying to them, pandemics are essentially psychological phenomena where the behavior of people determines how viruses are spread and contained and the other things. And people would look at me like I was mad. They would say, no, pandemics are just about some bug going viral. I said, no, it's psychology is hugely important. But now we're living in COVID. I think most people understand that.
Yeah, it looks like the overarching stressor for all of us when looking at your work and your research is ultimately uncertainty and finding ways to cope with uncertainty when we're talking about panic buying.
You're absolutely right. Uncertainty is a pervasive abstract stressor that is a part of all aspects of the pandemic. Even before the pandemic was declared, there was uncertainty as to whether there would be a pandemic, how bad it would be. And of course, now we're facing uncertainties around vaccine efficacy or uncertainty as to whether the pandemic is over. Are we just at the end of a wave or is it the end of the pandemic? So yeah, people who have trouble tolerating uncertainty are having a really tough time during COVID-19.
But then others ultimately follow, because then we have empty store shelves. Why does that happen?
What has been happening over the course of COVID-19 is people in the community have become conditioned Whenever we hear that there's going to be a shortage or a lockdown, it reliably triggers panic buying. And this happened during the so-called the threat of the gasoline shortage. It's as if this panic buying, it's not driven by a shortage in the supply chain, it's driven by the behavior of your fellow shoppers. So if you hear that there's a gas shortage, you're going to rush out because you're expecting other people to be rushing out. And of course, that whole thing snowballs.
I was reading an article that you were quoted in PsychWire, it was the Ask column, and you said something that was so poignant. You said, history has taught us that we're not very good at learning the lessons of the past. It's not like this is new.
Exactly. We've seen panic buying after just about every single pandemic. You go back 100 years during the Spanish flu, there was panic buying of stuff from pharmacies and so forth. So yeah, none of this is new. We should have foreseen this happening. Hmm.
What can we do when we feel the urge to go to the store and stock up on what we can?
Well, I think there are really only two ways of dealing with panic buying. One is to become a survivalist, where you always have stuff stockpiled up. An easier way is to wait a period of time. The research shows that episodes of panic buying last 7 to 10 days. They come in spurts. So if you hear about panic buying, most people think, oh, there's a gas shortage, there's going to be panic buying of gas, I better rush down to the gas station and get ahead of the crowd. Well, that kind of thinking puts you in the middle of the crowd because everyone's thinking the same thing. So if you hear about a shortage and people rushing out, my recommendation is to wait a week. If you can hang on for a week, you'll get there, the lineups will be gone, the stores or the gas stations will be replenished, and you'll get what you need without having to line up or having to hang out in crowds.
In the past year, when it comes to the risk of COVID-19 or the pandemic, that's just one layer. I mean, there was an intersection of a lot of other challenges over the past year, from racial justice to an election. How does that all compound when trying to find an anchor of control in kind of a situation or a year that just is, frankly, really, really weird and is out of control?
Exactly. I think all this social upheaval and turbulence and the flip-floppings of our leaders about what to do about managing COVID-19, that creates uncertainty or fuels uncertainty in communities. So if you have social upheaval that can lead people to doubt about the ability of our leaders to manage this pandemic, and if we lose faith in our leaders, we're not going to follow what they say. So trust in your leaders is hugely important in managing pandemics.
Do you think we're going to learn the lessons of this year when this happens again in the future?
No. Sorry, we won't.
No optimism isn't there.
2020, New Year's Eve 2020, there are plenty of media reports about people saying they wanted to forget 2020, forget the pandemic and move on. So I can understand why people want to, they're sick of COVID-19, they want to get back to where things were. So I can understand that, and many people will choose to forget the lessons. But when you're talking about health leaders or health authorities, we can't afford to forget the lessons. We need to learn what we can from COVID-19 to get things prepared for the challenges ahead, including a challenge of another pandemic or the challenges of climate change. And I'm thinking particularly about mental health resources, online and other sorts of resources for reaching people, including people in rural areas. We need to get those resources set up and running, not just for COVID, but for challenges ahead.
What are the overarching mental health consequences long term that you're focusing on and that you're concerned about?
There are a host of them. Just to put things in perspective, though, I should say most people are resilient. So most people in the community, you might be feeling stressed or anxious, you will bounce back for the most of you, but not everyone. And it's hard to predict what percentage could, it could be 20% of people who have lingering problems, but it will be all kinds of problems depending on what has happened to them during COVID. For people who got infected and hospitalized with the coronavirus, they're at risk of developing post-traumatic stress disorder. For people who've lost loved ones to COVID, there's the risk of depression and prolonged grief. For people who went into this pandemic with germ phobia or obsessive compulsive tendencies already, going into this pandemic for many people has just fueled their anxieties and their obsessions and compulsions, and they will require help in the aftermath. So there's a whole host of clinical problems that are waiting for us at the end of this pandemic.
As a psychologist, what conversations are taking place within your field in terms of treatment with these new challenges that you were just talking about?
One of the conversations has to do with the unfortunate fact that we've been retroactive in dealing with this pandemic. We should have been proactive. We should have anticipated what would be needed over a year ago. And in fact, they did that in China, in Chengdu, the city of Chengdu. They set up mental health resources at the beginning of March 2020 that involved information, TV shows to educate people, a call in line, triage to Zoom, where they could have face-to-face consultations with a mental health practitioner. That was set up within 2 weeks in early 2020. We should have been doing something like that, and we should still be looking at programs like that.
Professor and clinical psychologist at the University of British Columbia, Dr. Stephen Taylor, thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
Thanks so much, Vicky.
Still ahead, the history of Asian Americans spans two centuries in our country, but it is often overlooked. We're going to learn how one nonprofit is creating an overdue place in classrooms. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Inside on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Asian American history spans two centuries, first arriving in the United States in the mid-1800s. Asian Americans are now the fastest growing ethnic population in the United States, with more than 20 million Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders living in our country with a rich history, especially in California, where they make up 15% of the state's population. Now, classrooms of all grade levels are learning about the struggles and the triumph in ways really not done before. The Asian American Education Project put together dozens of lesson plans to create an overdue place in classrooms. Stuart Kuo is co-founder and co-director of the Asian American Education Project, and he joins us now to talk about the project and its goals to bring more Asian American history into classrooms. Thanks, Stuart, for joining Insight.
Thank you, Vicky.
Stuart, your journey really just spans like about 15, 16 years ago. In 2005, you saw a dire and essential need to tell the stories of Asian Americans in K-12 learning. How did this come about?
Well, I was the executive director and president of Asian Americans Advancing Justice since 1983. And I also taught one class a year at UCLA, Asian Americans and the Law. And I realized that students were coming into college without a background on Asian American history, struggles and contributions. So when they got to college, for many of them, it was the first time they heard about Asian American history. So about 14 years ago, I co-wrote a book with the UCLA Asian American Studies Center called Untold Civil Rights Stories, Asian Americans Speak Out for Justice. So, and then my wife, after I wrote that book and we distributed a few thousand books to the Los Angeles school district, she organized some teachers and they wrote 12 lesson plans. Then about 7 years ago, I was approached by the PBS producers who were trying to raise money to produce a five-hour documentary on Asian Americans, which appeared in May 2020. And then PBS asked my wife and I, Pat and I, to write the curriculum for the series. So we put together the 12 that I had before, plus 36 lesson plans. And then recently we wrote, along with teachers, three more lesson plans dealing with the current wave of anti-Asian hatred. So we have 51 lesson plans, and we hired Stanford to develop a teacher's guide. So they helped us develop five themes like racism, immigration, citizenship, identity. And so we are providing free teacher trainings using all of those materials.
Where can you find these lesson plans and teaching materials throughout the state?
They're all available for free on our website called AsianAmericanEDU.org, AsianAmericanEDU, one word, .org. So we have the curriculum already for teachers, and if they want to tune in to our free trainings, that's fine. We have the trainings on the current anti-Asian hate called Stand Against Hatred, plus we have the other 48 lesson plans, and it's grouped by themes, so there might be 10 lesson plans per theme, so that's all available fairly easily navigable on our website. And we probably will start another series of trainings in July in time for teachers coming back from their summer break. And we think that this will be a great addition because, unfortunately, Asian Americans are almost invisible even in California schools. There just isn't the material there available for teachers. Even in Los Angeles, which is the county with the largest number of Asian Americans of any county in the country, they don't have an Asian American ethnic studies course. So we're trying to work with them now to get the course, to get it into what we call survey courses that combine all the racial minority histories, but we're, you know, almost starting from scratch in terms of lesson plans. So we're trying to reach as many teachers and educators and community people as possible. We've been contacted by about 10 states, organizers and activists in about 10 states. So we're working with all of them to try to get the ethnic studies in. And of course, we're working with Black and Latino and Native American groups as well.
For the lesson plans that are already in classrooms, when you're getting feedback from teachers or even from students, have there been any aha moments or that stick with you? Because you're saying that this piece of history has been pretty much invisible for decades.
Well, I think the aha moment is that basically our history is American history. We are Americans, and some of the major constitutional, legal moments and cases are about Asian Americans. The first and only law that forbade an ethnic group from coming to the United States, the Chinese Exclusion Act, that was later expanded to all Asian groups, was the first and only time the United States has banned an entire ethnic group. And that lasted practically for 80 years, from 1882 until 1965. There are a number of citizenship cases that were decided in the 1920s, where if you weren't white, you could not become a U.S. citizen. Blacks were included in the 1870s. The Wong Kim Ark case stood for the proposition that people have birthright citizenship. That's a case that should be part of American history. It shouldn't be even in an ethnic studies course. So our attempt is to try to bring Asian American ethnic studies for sure, but in a larger sense, we want to try to integrate Asian American studies into American history, American California history. Those are very important for all of us to know about, not just students who take part in ethnic studies programs. So our long-term goal is to reach 1 million youth across the U.S. of all different backgrounds so that they know about the history, struggles, and contributions of Asian Americans. And we think that this time where Blacks and Latinos and Native Americans feel that they're treated as the other, this is a perfect time to unite with them to get ethnic studies in all of our schools. I wrote an op-ed piece in the LA Times on April 27th with a couple of the writers, and I stressed that point that our history is American history.
I was looking at the results from having this curriculum and these lesson plans in classrooms. You actually have some data showing that these classes increased academic success for students. It was a study done with Stanford and I believe San Francisco Unified School District. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, there was a study that Stanford initiated, and they found that students who take ethnic studies get a grade better. So instead of a C, they get a B, more than a grade difference. And this also applied to STEM students who took math or science or technology. It improved their test scores because I think that it became more real how everybody is part of America and how we need to learn about each other. Otherwise, we think it's a white society, but it's not a white society. And California needs to pave the way to show that all of us should be included. All of us should be included in the diversity. All of us should be part of the push for equity in our schools in particular. So I think that study showed that ethnic studies will help people and students across the board.
Finally, in the last minute that we have, I understand that you're partnering with the state, with the California Department of Education. Tell us more about this partnership and how this will impact lesson plans being taught throughout California.
Well, State Superintendent Tony Thurman has been great. He has invited me to participate on his press conferences. And then just last week, he and his staff organized a webinar. So I was our master trainer, who is a teacher in San Jose, was able to reach out to teachers who came on to Tony Thurman's webinar and did a training. Obviously, it was a short training in just an hour, but was able to show the teachers how to use our website, how to navigate the website, and how to bring Asian American history and contributions to the broad cross-section of students.
Stuart Kuo is co-founder and co-executive director of the Asian American Education Project. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Vicki.
Well, that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.